Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
WFAN and WFAN-FM New York, a radio.com sports station.
This portion of our program by Martin Shane Halls. Martin is an anthropologist on the faculty of Appalachian State University. Previously, he's taught at Columbia University, Johns Hopkins University, University of Pennsylvania. Previously, he was the author of The Paradox of Power and Intimate Exclusion. He is joining us now to talk with us about a publication entitled Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia. Interesting title for a book. Equality Reimagined. Nice to have you join us on our program. Good morning.
Nice to be with you, Bob.
That title, including the word utopia in that, you know, how much of a risk was that? Because I asked the question because you say utopia, and most people have an image, an idea in mind, but utopia also can be very easily misunderstood.
It can, and it was a risk to use the word. But I wanted to use it really intentionally and chose to use it intentionally because the idea that we usually have and part of the cynicism that's attached to the word by some people derives from the idea that we can critique society as it is, but can't or shouldn't imagine a better society. And I don't think that's true. I think that's really despairing to feel that you can't imagine something better. And so I want to do that, and I want to reclaim for the word utopia the hopefulness that can and should go with it.
When you use the word utopia, to you, what does that mean?
It means a much better society than the one that we're living in, one that thinks through the practicalities, and in the book I do think through the practicalities that exist in terms of human nature, and yet realizes both the bad and the good about humans in the possibilities of human nature. And so it's kind of a hard question that you're asking in a way because we don't have any other word really to describe that better society that we can possibly imagine. And to me, that's really revealing that we don't have a vocabulary of talking about things that are hopeful and things that can be imagined. And when I use the word imagination, I don't mean that a utopia should be something fanciful that's disconnected from reality. I know that's one of the connotations people often associate with it. I have grounded my utopia in social science research. I've given very concrete and practical proposals, and my plan and my aim is to inspire people to think about another world that could be possible.
As part of that discussion and exploration, you examine the concepts of happiness And you also look at, I guess, a certain part of human happiness being tied to hierarchy. What do you mean by that?
Happiness is not tied to hierarchy. It's tied to inequality. We sometimes think wrongly that if we are the top of a hierarchy, if we make more money and we get more power, then we'll achieve a kind of ultimate happiness. And the reason that the subtitle of the book is Equality Reimagined is because what I show in the book is that equality is central to happiness for all people, and that hierarchy causes anxiety and depression for those both on the bottom and those on the top.
Well, would you say that in a way we're kind of hardwired to believe in or perhaps even value hierarchy?
I would be reluctant to say that.
Okay.
Because, and here's why. So I am an anthropologist and study contemporary culture, but anthropologists also look at the evolution of humans. And if you go back to the very, very beginning, by which I mean the beginning of humans appearing on Earth in Africa roughly 200,000 years ago, from that time all the way up until about 6,000 years ago, we lived a very cooperative life, we lived a very egalitarian life, and we survived because we were cooperative and because we shared everything with each other. And sometimes when I tell that to my friends, they say, oh, that sounds like your imagination or ideology, but it's not. It's reality that's been carefully documented by anthropologists. And so what that means is that for 95% of human existence on Earth, we have lived as egalitarians, and we have survived as egalitarians. And so I know that we can do it because we have done it for so long before. What's really anomalous is perhaps our desire for hierarchy. There is that part in us. But I am hesitant to use the word or the concept of hardwired, because one of the things about humans is precisely that so much of human ability is flexible, and humans respond to different kinds of environments. And that's part of the hopefulness of hierarchy, of utopia, not hierarchy, is that if you change the conditions of society, humans will act differently. So does that make all sense?
I think
so.
I think so. I'm trying to digest that, too, as you're saying that. And I'm also thinking about, you know, so many different areas where we can go in this discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Think back to Jane Goodall's work,
mm-hmm.
okay? Because those were really pioneering studies that she
mm-hmm.
did with chimpanzees. And that was back in the 1960s, relatively speaking, was a long time ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those kinds of lessons, do they stand up today?
Well, that's a very important question to ask. I have a great deal of respect, as most people do, for Jane Goodall. But one of the things that's important to know is that she found different things. There's a scholar who looked very carefully at her work and at the work of other primatologists who've worked out in the field. And the reason that we look at chimpanzees is because they're the closest living ancestors to humans. And so what some scholars have argued in the past is that because chimpanzees, Jane Goodall found, engage in something like warfare, that warfare must be somehow hardwired into the primate, including into the human legacy. But what the scholar, Margaret Power, who looked at Jane Goodall's work found is that in the early days of Jane Goodall's work, when she was first doing her work, she just looked at the chimpanzees in their natural environment, and they were quite egalitarian and quite cooperative and didn't show the kinds of things that she found later. And what she started to do was to provision the chimpanzees with bananas. And provisioning is an unnatural situation, but it's done reluctantly because it's hard to observe chimps in a natural environment. And so she had her workers put bananas into a box that they could open and close at will. That is, the workers could open and close the box at will because they had limited bananas. And so the chimps would all gather, the box would be open, they would take bananas, and then the box would be closed by the workers. And it created a really unnatural feeding situation, a lot of frustration. And it led to a really toxic kind of response by the chimpanzees. It's only after that point of provisioning that the chimpanzees started to show the really aggressive desire among some chimps to become what people call despots, the kind of desire for certain chimps to become dominant over other chimps. And all kinds of other things that happen, the warfare, the violence, the aggression, all of those came out of a very unnatural situation. And so what that says is that chimps really aren't in their natural environment, pre-provisioning, as aggressive and warlike as people have thought.
Mm-hmm.
And because they're our ancestors, that means the same is true of us. It's hard for us to see that because we do absolutely live in a very hierarchical society today. And hierarchy, as of about 6,000 years ago, became endemic to the human condition. But interestingly, some of the theories about how and why that happened 6,000 years ago have some resonance with the things that Jane Goodall found. As we settled down and became farmers in certain areas that were very productive, the population grew, and when the population grew, there was struggle between some groups against other groups. They went to war with them and conquered them and enslaved them, and that was the beginnings of hierarchy, most likely. That's one of the most common theories. So an unnatural environment that began with the origins of agriculture that concentrated food and led to certain kinds of aggressions and frustrations among humans most likely led to the beginnings of hierarchy for the first time in a very, very long history.
Martin Shaneholtz has helped us get our program started this morning. I'm Bob Salter, and hopefully you are enjoying this discussion. His latest book is entitled Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia. We're going to explore more things involving utopia as we continue on our program this Sunday morning.
Radio.com.
Bob Salter, Sports Radio 101.9 FM,
The Fan,
and Sports Radio 66, WFAN.
Martin Shaneholtz is talking with us on our program on The Fan. Good morning, everybody. This is Bob Salter. As we move into this second part of our discussion with you, Martin, when you look at, and one of the things you talk about in your book, which deals with talking about the idea of utopia, you look at the concept of learning and education. I'm curious, for the benefit of folks listening to us, how would you see that kind of playing out? And would schooling in utopia, Martin, bear any resemblance to what we imagine or what we view as schooling today?
not a whole lot of resemblance, and that's because we as children, of course, as young children, kind of before we go to school, love to learn and are curious and intensely curious about the world. And we don't have to have anyone making us learn how to speak a language or to inquire about the world. And I think one of the saddest things is that we take that very human propensity to learn, and we start to require that to be engaged in. And, you know, anytime you compel something from someone, it almost always reduces the joy that you can feel from it. I remember one student saying she loves to read history books, but the minute that a professor signs a history book to her, she finds it a burden. And I think we all can relate to that. I sometimes say to my students, imagine that whatever it is that you like to do, if you like going to the movies or like going to the beach, if I said, okay, this weekend you have to go to the beach and you have to go to the movies, those suddenly would become unpleasant activities. And so it's the coercion and the anxiety that goes along with it that's in so much of school, in which all of us who teach can see, and unfortunately can see increasing, that we need to question the nature of school. So the bottom line for me is that school, like work, should be pleasurable, and there's no reason that the pleasure of school shouldn't be the central purpose of schooling. We unfortunately attach a negative connotation to pleasure the same way that we attach a negative connotation to utopia, and yet we shouldn't. Pleasure and happiness are what we all strive for. And learning is a central human desire, very central, and not one just limited to children. And so schools should be pleasurable. Pleasure should be a central function of schools. And schooling should be for all ages. And so that's a kind of summary of some of the changes that I would make in schooling.
Universal education, would that be part of what you would like to see?
I'd like to see it provided to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And I know this is going to be a provocative statement in some ways. I wouldn't like to see it compelled in the same way that it is. I'd like to see an absence of grading and tests and all of the things that students dislike. And I know that there will be listeners who will say, well, if you don't require it, no one will go to school. But that's actually not true. I worked in an area of China in the mountains the second time that I did my China research, where kids were often not able to go to school because they lived in the high mountains. This is an ethnic minority group in China. And I remember hearing so often stories from kids saying that they would beg their parents to go to school, that they had seen the schoolrooms down the mountain, and they talked with such enthusiasm about their desire to learn. And by it not being compelled and by their actually being told by their parents you can't and shouldn't go to school because it's dangerous to get there, the kids, of course, had a great desire to go to school. And I remember one young man who had started at 7 going to school because he begged his parents to go and enjoyed it and appreciated it the whole way.
Mm. Another aspect of many people's lives, work.
Yes.
This whole, for lack of a better term, dichotomy between work mm-hmm. and play, how do you see that playing out? And let me just mention, too, for the benefit of anybody who's just joining us in discussion, We're talking with Martin Shainholz. Martin is an anthropologist on the faculty of Appalachian State University, and he's talking with us about his latest book entitled Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia, Equality Reimagined.
Yes, so work versus play. Well, that's a division that we establish in society rather artificially, because as I said a minute ago, things that are play we can turn into work. Things that are work under the right conditions we can see as being joyful and playful. And we create that division because we have a moral taint to the idea of playing. We see it as something that's fun but not virtuous, and oftentimes know that we should feel guilty if we're quote-unquote playing and not doing our quote-unquote work. And I think that division is a really unfortunate one, because we all know how much it divides us and pulls us in different directions between wanting to be productive and virtuous and yet also wanting to enjoy ourselves. And there's no reason that that has to be the case. Work became odious to us partly because the Puritans attached a moral virtue to it, but a moral virtue as long as it was seen as a sacrifice. And so the puritanical tradition that people refer to in America is one that disparages pleasure and play and elevates work. And that's a historical creation of a division that doesn't need to exist. And it wouldn't exist if work weren't coerced and weren't given that kind of artificial elevation, precisely because it's not pleasurable. If work and play were both engaged in equally, then we could accord both of them equal value. I think it's really sad that so many things that people do with such joy and such engagement as what we often refer to as hobbies or play are things that we ourselves and other people denigrate. I sing in a voluntary choir in New York City. We're really great, and yet the fact that we're volunteers and not paid means that we don't attract the attention of other people just by definition, because we're not workers. And that's unfortunate, because lots of times amateurs are as good, if not better, than some professionals.
Mm. But, you know, we live in a society where everything, or excuse me, not everything, but mm-hmm. many things are valued because of their quote-unquote worth, and that worth is tied to dollars and cents.
Yeah,
I guess
it is.
How do we, in utopia, how would we get past that, and would there even be basically a need for money?
I really would like to see money disappear, and so one of my proposals in Utopia is that money as an instrument of exchange, as an instrument of the storage of wealth, be eliminated. And I know that's also a provocative suggestion, but if you look at humans, there are so many things that we do without having to be paid that are really, really productive and creative and important. One being parenting, very, very hard activity, of course. I don't have to tell anyone that. And yet it's something that we're not paid to do. I think there's a certain blindness among us to so many of the things that people do without being paid, so many very, very important things that we don't realize that people will engage in things and, you know, will, if you see someone engaging in a kind of charity, they can do it with great gusto without being paid. So Money creates all kinds of funny distortions too. The 2008 recession was created out of macroeconomic conditions that I don't fully understand and only economists can explain. And what's strange about it is that money in a market economy are supposed to be good at matching supply and demand, and yet the demand that existed after 2008 crash was the same as the demand before, and yet the supply and demand were out of whack. And so many people were thrown out of work for no real reason. And when I say no real reason, what I mean is that the needs of people and the ability of the world to meet those needs were the same before the crash, after the crash, were the same as before the crash, and yet the crash happened and led to this huge dislocation. Why? It doesn't need to happen.
The book is Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia. We are in a discussion that I hope you are finding interesting. I have always been intrigued by the concept of utopia, and that's why I'm sort of picking at the brain of Martin Shainholtz, who's the author of this book and our guest in this portion of our program. Another guest will join us before we finish our 6 o'clock hour of our program. Martin has shared so many areas, and you know, there's other things that I want to touch upon as we continue in this discussion this Sunday morning.
Radio.com.
It's Sunday morning on The Fan. Good morning, everybody. This is Bob Salter. Hopefully you are having a good weekend and got some nice plans on tap for today. We're in a discussion in our 6 o'clock hour here with Martin Shainholtz. He is joining us as the author of Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia. And, you know, one of the things is thinking, and I try to always imagine folks listening to us, this thought may have passed through their minds as well as they're listening to our discussion today. How do you think utopia would be administered, Martin?
A question that I can only give a partial answer to, and I have a whole chapter on the administration of utopia. But one of the things when I thought about entrenched power and the dangers of entrenched power that can happen in any society, even a utopian one, I thought to myself that American juries are a kind of model of ways that power doesn't become entrenched. They're voluntary, they're temporary, people don't really want to serve on them oftentimes, and yet we do, out of a sense of obligation and devotion, we go serve on them, serve for a certain period of time, and then are relieved of our duties. And so I've created a kind of model of administration of utopia in which the administrators will be voluntary, they'll be randomly chosen, like a jury. They'll administer for a period of time, and then they'll rotate off service and other people will come on. And that's not the only thing that will happen in utopia to work to prevent the kind of entrenchment of power, but it's a very important thing that will help to provide to prevent entrenched power from happening.
Mm.
I really want to see everyone involved, not just in, you know, today democracy means voting for people and then forgetting about politics for many people until 4 years later. And society should not be that way. Anyone and everyone who has good ideas should be involved in putting forth those ideas, debating them with other people, and having a chance to experiment. So I also create a kind of realm for experimentation in utopia, too. And I think that's really important, that it be a living and breathing, that society should be a living and breathing organism, that it can be changed and experimented with by people, and that all people who want to should have a chance to engage in putting forth their own good ideas. I put forth mine in the book, but I hope that other people will join in the conversation.
Martin, when you talk about some of the things that you're sharing with us in this book. And the book, again, is entitled Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia, Equality Reimagined. We're talking with Martin Shainhalls on our program. I'm Bob Salter. Your idea of utopia, I don't think I'm overly simplifying this to say it's really built on expectations of people being at their best, okay, mm-hmm. rather than their least.
Mm-hmm.
But then how would you deal with utopians who are going to disagree, or perhaps outsiders who are going to try to threaten the peace?
That's, of course, a really challenging question,
mm-hmm.
and one, again, that I can only give a short answer to here. But one of the things that I want to do as much as possible is not use kind of punitive measures against people. If there are people who don't want to be part of utopia, they don't have to be. And so I've suggested that there could be a way that land could be set aside for those people, that they could go onto the land and not be a part of utopia, but it wouldn't be a kind of exile or imprisonment or punishment for their not acceding to the desires of utopia. They could come and go and visit people in utopia. People could visit them, and they would be free to create their own society on land as they wish. So there's nothing compulsory about utopia. And I think that's a really, really important principle, obviously something that I've articulated throughout our discussion, that it not be compulsory and not be punitive. And so that's my response in short for how people who disagreed or weren't happy with utopia could be accommodated.
Most interesting concepts contained in Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia, Equality Reimagined. Most interesting concepts contained in our discussion, hopefully, as well. Martin Shainhalls, an anthropologist on the faculty at Appalachian State University, joining us to talk with us about this book. Thank you very much for joining us, and also thank you for providing some things and hopefully some inspiration for thought on the part of folks listening to us. Good luck with this book and with your work.
Thanks so much, Bob.
We're joined in this portion of our program on The Fan, Sports Radio 66, Sports Radio 101.9 here in New York City. I'm Bob Salter, and joined by Candy Pickard, who is interim president and CEO of National Down Syndrome Society. She is joining us on our program. We'll be talking about the 2019 National Play Campaign. And it's nice to have you join us on our program, first of all.
Thank you. It's great to be here on a Sunday morning.
The National Down Syndrome Society, and that's quite a mouthful as it is, goes by the acronym NDSS. Can you tell us a little bit about what it is that the society covers?
Absolutely. So NDSS is the leading human rights organization for all individuals with Down syndrome. Our priority within NDSS is really to provide state-of-the-art comprehensive programming to the Down syndrome community for their families, and we cover that in a few different areas, and one of those is our advocacy and policy center, our inclusive health and sports program. We also host the Buddy Walk. We do our flagship Buddy Walk in New York City in September, and then our last bucket is around outreach resources and our public awareness. For us, we really want all people with Down syndrome to have the opportunity to have a quality life, realize their life aspirations, and be welcome in their local communities.
What about, I guess, even promoting public awareness of mm-hmm. what people with Down syndrome face?
Individuals with Down syndrome, right now, they're living a lot longer. In the 1980s, 1983 to be exact, individuals with Down syndrome were living to the age of 25.
Wow.
Now folks are living into their 60s and 70s, which says a lot for not only, our communities, but also, modern medicine. We're living longer, healthier lives, and a lot of that comes to being included in our communities, in school. Now we're seeing so many more post-secondary education programs and employment. Our folks are working and, having long-standing careers, which is exciting.
It is exciting. And when we're talking about the 2019 National Play Campaign, we've touched upon this once before on this program a number of years back, but How do you explain what the campaign's all about?
Sure. So PLAY stands for Promoting a Lifetime of Activity for Youth. And it's a public awareness campaign from the Professional Baseball Athletic Trainer Society, another mouthful, goes by PBAT, in conjunction with the Ruderman Family Foundation, ourselves with NDSS, Taylor Hooten Foundation, and the Henry Schein Cares Foundation. And it was created in 2004 to really raise awareness about young people's health issues, disability inclusion, you know, both which are major concerns in the U.S. And the PLAY campaign really, you know, aims to combat child obesity, promoting healthy living, and disability inclusion among young people in America.
So when we're talking about the involvement of NDSS in the PLAY campaign, I mean, what does this mean for the society being part of this?
Well, I just wrapped up. I was in Cleveland this week and in Kansas City, and it's really exciting. I mean, for us to be able to, you know, have a platform to speak about the role that people with disabilities have played, not only throughout baseball's history, but the lessons that we can go forward with health and wellness and just being, you know, part of this exciting event with their typical peers. It's really amazing.
The PBATs that you mentioned, mm-hmm. Professional Baseball Athletic Trainers Society, what do they do?
So they work in conjunction with Major League Baseball to host these different campaigns. Since 2004, I believe we've hosted close to 300 PLAY events inside all 30 Major League Baseball parks. And they've really reached these communities with positive message about, you know, really making smart life choices, having that active lifestyle. And it's really an exciting opportunity for our athletic trainers within professional baseball and the players. This week we had a handful of players that came out and did the different clinic with the youth that were there at those particular campaigns.
What's the atmosphere like at a PLAY event?
Oh, I tell you, it's an exciting event. I think most people really get excited to just be in a Major League Baseball stadium, but to have the opportunity to actually, you know, be on the field, do a little, you know, throwing clinic, or, you know, learn about nutrition and health and wellness, you know, while sitting in the dugout of a Major League Baseball opportunity is really exciting. I mean, even for me, my youngest son, Mason, was born with Down syndrome, and I've actually kind of had him tag along to a couple of these events with me. And, you know, we love baseball, and just to be in that type of environment, it's intoxicating.
Well, what's it like for him? I mean, what does he, I guess, what kind of feedback is he giving, whether it's just in terms of reaction or things he says?
Yeah, you know, for Mason, this is his first year playing baseball.
Mm-hmm.
He's watched his siblings play baseball over, my oldest is 17, so over the last 15 years. But, you know, for him, it's just really being able to just be there, run the bases, you know, is exciting. You know, he loves to bat, so being part of the, you know, clinics when they do some little batting type of drills is really fun for him. But, you know, the feedback is he wants to do it more. And, you know, for him, it's looking at the big picture, and, you know, his big brother wants to play college ball, and I'm sure that, you know, that's his vision too when he looks at it now as a 7-year-old.
That's got to be kind of neat as it is.
It is. As a parent, you know, Mason is my fourth. He's my youngest, and we didn't know that he was diagnosed with Down syndrome until after he was born. And so, you know, we immediately thought of, you know, what limitations he was going to have. And now 7 years, he lives a healthy, you know, fantastic life with his siblings. He's included in his school programs and everything that he does within school. And I just look for a bright future for him, you know, with going to college, and, you know, if he wants to play ball, or if he wants to, you know, find a job doing what he loves. It's just the American dream, as all of us have.
Mm. That's good. It's so inspiring to hear that. Certainly thank you for sharing that with us. Is there an online resource in terms of a website that you can share with us for the society?
Absolutely. So our web address is ndss.org. And there's more information just around our organization and what we do within the Down syndrome community. And then we do have a link on there for those that may want to participate in any upcoming PLAY events. You can drop down and register, and we'd love to have as many participate. It is an inclusive campaign, so everybody's welcome.
Candy Pickard, who is Interim President, CEO of National Down Syndrome Society, joining us on our program. and also talking with us about the 2019 National Play Campaign, hopefully a very successful effort this year as well. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure.
And certainly good luck continued with your work, and give that youngster of yours a hello from us.
I will, absolutely. We'll be on the diamond today, so I absolutely will.
Interesting discussion with Candy Pickard, wrapping up our 6 o'clock hour of our program this morning. What we're going to do is take a pause for a few messages, a look around the sporting world in our top of the hour update. We got a lot more to get to in our program in the 7 o'clock hour here on The Fan.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.